Turning Tides is an Antics Entertainment affiliate. You can find us on social media at The Turning Tides Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube, and at Turning Tides Pod on Twitter. For more information, or if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast, please contact us at theturningtidespodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Joseph Pascone, and I'd like to welcome you all to the Turning Tides podcast. Today, we are joined by a very special guest. Alexander Michibridze is one of the world's preeminent historians covering the Napoleonic era. In 2020, he released The Napoleonic Wars, A Global History, which has since been lauded as one of the great nonfiction works of the decade and has won numerous awards from prestigious literary organizations such as the Society for Military History. In 2022, he wrote an incredible biography covering Russian General Mikhail Kutuzov and was once again recognized by the Society of Military History with a Distinguished Book Award. He also recently translated and co-edited the harrowing personal memoirs of Russian artillerist Ilya Timofeyevich Rudovitsky. Alexander, thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing today? And did I just butcher that name, or did I do okay?
No. I see you are practicing.
Oh, thank you.
I'm doing well. I really appreciate that. Was overly generous introduction.
Oh, no. I could say much, much more generous things. Don't worry.
I'm delighted to be here. I look forward to our conversation.
All right, let's get it started. So I have my first question here is, how do you balance your time with your writing as well as your daily lecturing at LSU? Do you find it difficult to, you know, manage both your literary ambitions and the classes you teach simultaneously, or do they sort of, you know, flow together?
All of us have our private lives in addition to, you know, our professional. So I'm a soccer coach for my kids. I'm a Boy Scout leader, and I, you know, volunteer in different places. Like all people, you know, I try to have a kind of well-rounded life. The key to all of this is time management, right? I oftentimes hear, how do you kind of manage to do this and this and this? Well, it's all about time management and really finding time, kind of deliberately thinking how you spend time and using kind of, you know, 24 hours that you have more efficiently. I get up early. On any day, I'm up by 6 a.m. and I go to bed late. So usually I stay up until 1:30. So if you're willing to engage in research and teaching and extracurricular activities, plus spend time, you know, with your friends, family, then you have to, in many ways, time manage yourself. And that's what I do. I have my own regimen. Can I know on any given day what I do, actually almost to the hour. I can kind of see where I can fit things if I want to do them. This weekend, I know that my kids have competitions, so that means I can use those couple of hours to do something else.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, that's a great answer to that. So for this next one, you grew up in the country of Georgia during a period when that polity had only recently gained its independence. Did these experiences you had in your youth, did they get you interested in history, or was it something you grew fond of later? Because usually there's always that moment, either when you're a kid or you're in your, you know, adolescence, where you get interested in history. Everyone has that one thing that they can point to. At least I can.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I actually start my lectures whatever topic I lecture for my students, the course, at the beginning of the course, I always kind of share a little bit of my personal experiences. because I think vast majority of students that come to my to my university to take the history courses, they come with the experience of history that is not necessarily a positive one. Oftentimes they talk about history as being boring and kind of the way it was maybe taught and the way they were tested turned them off from history. But I always tell them it cannot be, right? History is about your personal experiences. And more crucially, history is not dead as such, right? We oftentimes think that it's past and it's long kind of been done and over, but it's with us. And I often tell them about my experiences. I was born and raised in Soviet Union, in a small remote place in northern Kazakhstan, a place that was built up by German prisoners of war and dissidents who were resettled there by the Soviet government. So even though my family is of Georgian origin, I was not born in Georgia, but I grew up. Kind of my childhood experience, the thing that shaped me really was longing to return to my historic homeland. And my father, after I would be done with the Soviet school, would come home and do the kind of the official homework. He would give me his own homework, which was all about kind of studying history that was not taught in elementary or high school. And that was a story kind of Georgian independence, what Georgians were up to, or more broadly, kind of what Caucasus was up to before the Russians show up, and more crucially, before Soviet Union was established. And so that, you know, some of my earliest memories are actually sitting as a kid. I might have been maybe 6 or 7 years old and drawing a massive timeline, kind of gluing the sheets of paper together and creating a timeline of Georgian history and kind of color coding it, you know, by what events were taking place in on any given year. So, yeah, I grew up with history in both as a passion, as an interest, but also because I was well aware why Georgia was not independent, why my father was in this godforsaken place in the middle of nowhere, and why, when I was 11, 12 years old, why the independence movement was up and coming in Georgia. So I think if you talk to any Georgian in that sense, certainly for my generation, they would have been well aware of wider historical context. I always tell my students that there are parts of the world where history feels like it happened yesterday. Right? Mm-hmm. So in Georgia, in Armenia, you oftentimes talk about events that are 800-900 years old as if they happened yesterday, right? Mm-hmm. A long history, long popular memory of it. And that certainly shaped my perceptions of history and what it is and how valuable and important it is.
Yeah, yeah. I'm coming from a similar place. Like my experience was when I was an adolescent, my parents got me a globe because I don't know, that's what they did for their first kid. They're like, let's get them a globe. They weren't particularly interested in history. They were from Long Island, so it wasn't like some big well-recorded thing there. But I remember just pointing at the different countries on the map and being like, and asking my mom's friend who was interested in history, did these two countries fight in a war? And I remember pointing on India and then Great Britain. And I was like, there's no way. I'm totally going to stump her. She's gonna have no idea. And she's like, oh yeah, they fought all the time. I was like, what? And the little island won. The little island won each time. How is this possible? But that was my personal experience.
That's brilliant. I think a way to introduce anyone to history, really. The other way, I always ask people, what's your last name? Do you know the story behind your last name, right? Mm-hmm. And usually, in most cases, people do know their family's kind of origins and where they come from, but maybe not tied to the bigger, broader kind of narrative. So oftentimes you hear, let's say if I have a student of the Germanic last name, and I'll ask, tell me about your family. They would tell me, they moved, somebody moved here in mid-19th century. And I would immediately kind of explain, we can presume why they moved because, if it's in 1840s and 50s, we know the connection to historical developments in Germany. And especially, let's say for Italian, anyone from Italian, the Italian last name and surname, chances are your ancestors moved from south of Italy at the turn of the 19th, 20th century. And there are historical reasons for it, right? And
so yes, I think definitely.
There is a way to make history personal.
Yeah, and that's one of the biggest challenges, I think, with teaching history today, especially in like public school or high school, because 9 times out of 10, you have like the gym teacher who couldn't be bothered, and he's the one teaching the history class, and he's just trying to get it over with so he can...
Yeah, exactly. History sometimes is shortchanged by that, but mm-hmm. I'm funny that you mentioned it, because I just came, we were kind of corresponding, and I was telling you that I was rushing to the meeting. But the event that I came from was for the high school students. We had over 200 high school students on our campus, and we kind of divide them up into different groups, and they could choose an event to attend. And my event was history through board gaming. Wow. And that's how I do. And I do a lot of interactive gaming in my courses. So if we talk about Treaty of Versailles, we will read the documents. But I find increasingly that students oftentimes kind of burn out from writing so many essays. So why not reenact the events of Treaty of Versailles, reenact the events of Congress of Vienna? Mm-hmm. Last spring, I taught a course where each student, and I had 26 of them, each student had a role to play from the outbreak or from the event of the July crisis of 1914, and took about 3 weeks from my World War I class to really get a sense why war took place at a time when seemingly no one wanted an all-out war. So I think that's a way to engage your audience, right? Mm-hmm. Reading sources is crucial, but it's kind of how you approach them is also matters.
Yes, definitely. That's a great answer. So next I have, when you moved to America, you began to seriously specialize in the Napoleonic era. So the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars concluded over 200 years ago. What inspired you to write and explore about these conflicts and some of the more nebulous aspects of them in the 21st century?
I never intended to be a historian. I love history, absolutely. I have a passion for it, but never intended to be a historian. I initially went to law school, became a lawyer, practiced law, and it's only later I was like, let me try history too. And that's when, when you go to graduate school, they always, and I ask the same of my students. I actually had a student this morning who came after taking one of my courses, came and said, listen, I want to switch major and do history. Can you talk to me what's the future kind of holds? And usually it's a depressing kind of conversation because the field of history is going through a massive, massive turmoil kind of change. Yeah. And it's very hard to...
What even is history anymore? Does anyone even know?
Right. I mean, the struggle for historical memory, the study... And especially we overproduce PhDs in history. That means there's a glut of PhD candidates, graduates, and not enough vacancies. So history professors are not dying fast enough. So when I came there, I had my conversation with my professor, and in fact his portrait is right here behind me. Because he had a absolutely decisive role in my life. I completely changed it, the trajectory of it, what I intended to do. We sat down and talked, and ultimately I was inclined leaning to do a revolutionary era, and he convinced me to do a Napoleonic period. And then help me kind of become what I am. So everything I know about the craft of history is because he would sit down and meticulously kind of guide me and edit my papers and teach me how to ask proper questions, how to pursue those research opportunities. And one of the, as I was going through the graduate school, one of the kind of areas that already I could see was the fact that most historical fields feel like a silo, where historians kind of work in their own silo with very little interaction between the silos. And one of the things that struck me as being a, you know, kind of as a person who was born in what is today Kazakhstan, who grew up in Georgia, received education in Germany, in Poland, studied in Hungary, right, kind of internationally. So yeah. What struck me is that Napoleonic Wars in traditional narrative was very Eurocentric, and I would say Western Eurocentric. So it's kind of about experiences of British, French, less so, you would be surprised, Spanish or Italian experiences, right? And so that always struck me as unusual. And then the more I kind of studied and kind of get a better understanding of the field, I realized Napoleonic War is a war of global impact, and yet there is nothing really substantive that's been written about Napoleonic Wars as a global conflict. So there are plenty of books about Napoleon, plenty of books about Napoleonic War in Europe, mm-hmm. but they tend to follow the same kind of pattern. It's about focused about French experiences, maybe British experiences in Peninsula, French experiences in Austria, Prussia, Russia, and then back. But what about Middle East? Right? What about Caucasus? Right? What about India? You are just mentioning it, right? The British conquest of India takes place during the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars. It's actually completed by 1815. So I thought that it's important to kind of create a narrative that will try to showcase the complexity of history. Mm-hmm. And so that's the reason I wrote that book, which turned out to be more successful than I could have ever dreamt about.
That's a great answer, and it's a great segue to my next question. So the Napoleonic era, it was defined by turbulence, violence, and upheaval. And you do a masterful job of showcasing that these symptoms affected the entire world. In your opinion, which areas, and I guess we could go by continent, which areas were most affected by this conflict and why?
So I would say in the book, I have several fundamental themes, right? Fundamental points that I'm trying to make. So one is, as I mentioned, this idea of moving away from Eurocentric lenses and focusing on experiences, politics, developments in Europe, and especially, again, it's not just Europe, actually. As I said, it's Western and Central Europe. Until just recently, literally 2 years ago, we didn't have a wonderful, you know, kind of study of Southeastern Europe during this revolutionary era. Now we do. There's a wonderful new book about Southeastern Europe during the revolutionary era, or about experience of Northern Europe, kind of not brought to the attention. And that's kind of Europe as such. I'm not even talking about the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. So first, it's move away from the traditional Western and Central European lenses. And I am arguing that the ideological currents that flowed from the French Revolution, right, were carried forward and, well, yes, we can talk about it, contradicted oftentimes by Napoleon during the Napoleonic Wars. And so I want to show how these ideological currents reached the Middle East, because Napoleonic invasion, or technically it's French invasion, right, mm-hmm. led by General Bonaparte in 1798, as I argue, was the first case of liberal imperialism. There are plenty of cases of imperial expansions before, but this is a first case of a liberal imperialism where you have a republic, a revolutionary republic, arguing that it's going to a country, to a region, ostensibly to free local citizens and bring the benefits of quote-unquote civilization, right? Or we can kind of switch our attention to the Latin America, where, of course, the revolutionary Napoleonic era has a profound impact, bringing down decisively so the Spanish Empire, and instead creating, you know, 24 different independent states that with their own kind of complex path ahead of them. Now, I think one of the crucial things that I try to point out in the book is that this period, revolutionary Napoleonic era, changed the balance of forces, you can say balance of power between the different parts of the globe. I'm pointing out that Europe was not predetermined to become this kind of superior, dominant, hegemonic region that eventually came to be, you know, what we know, right? We know that there were extensive right, powerful pre-industrial empires, and this was not exclusively European experience. Chinese Empire, Mughal Empire, Ottoman Empire held enormous territories in the 18th century, and these powers could, and on many occasions did effectively compete with Europeans. I think my argument is that during this revolutionary Napoleonic era, this relationship changed profoundly. Right? And here it's part of it is ideology, right? So revolutionary ideology that challenges the legitimacy of rulers, experiments with new techniques. Part of it is the military experimentation, right? Emergence of far more efficient ways of organizing your military. And part of it, of course, crucial part, if you ask me, is of course industrial development that takes place in Europe, starting in Britain, France, and so on, that absolutely changes the relationship between Europe and the rest of the world. And so from Napoleonic warfare forward, we see then war as always a powerful catalyst for modernization and change. Right? And so that's the focus I have in the book.
So dovetailing with some of the stuff you said towards the end of your last statement there, would you consider, you wouldn't necessarily consider the Napoleonic and revolutionary eras a period of intense technological breakthroughs, but maybe an intense period of reforming of society and civilization itself. Would that be fair to say?
Yes, because I'm not, and it would be very difficult for anyone to argue that Napoleonic Wars represented a technological breakthrough in terms of military. Same musket that was used in the American Revolution, same, you know, essentially what was used in Seven Years' War is being used in Napoleonic Wars. But what has changed, right, what has changed is that one of the core legacies of this period lay in government centralization, greater proficiency of bureaucracies, greater efficiency in military recruitment, greater financial regulation, great efficiency in tax gathering. And so all of this are the byproducts of this war. Whether we look at the centralization process that is initiated by French Revolution, Jacobins focus on centralizing to, or Napoleon's tendencies, right, of creating this kind of highly efficient bureaucratic imperial regime. All of these are crucial in kind of shaping what European societies are really about. In the post-Napoleonic period, military strength is inherently linked to administrative excellence, financial prowess, and industrial capacity. So you have to have this kind of four key ingredients. And those are the ingredients that give, let's say, British an advantage in its long-standing relationship with India. Right? There are wonderful news books that came just over the last 2 years showcasing the complexity of English/British experiences in India. You know, they've been there since the end of the 16th century. And that relationship profoundly has changed in late 18th and especially in early 19th century. Because Britain gains administrative excellence, financial prowess, industrial capacity, and the military strength. And same applies for, let's say, France's relationship in with Africa. The colonialism begins in 1830. Although you can argue that the French colonialism in Africa begins with Napoleon in 1798, and it kind of picks up the steam in 1830 with the invasion of Algiers, and so on and so on. So that's the point I'm making, is that in order to fight these wars, Nietzsche, of course, has that famous expression, right, about delving into abyss and abyss looking at you. Essentially, what I'm arguing in the book is that to follow that Nietzschean postulate that these powers, these great powers in Europe, in order to beat Napoleon, in order to beat this revolutionary France, had to look into the revolutionary abyss long enough for the abyss to gaze back at them. And what I mean by that gaze is that they all have to change. Mm-hmm. Right? None of these powers come out of this conflict intact. They came out reformed, reorganized. Look at Prussia, right? In the wake of the collapse of 1806, Prussians begin the great reforms that takes them to a very different place than they were in before the war. Same applies for Russia. Sure, Russia maintained kind of overall conservative kind of social economic model, and serfdom still is present in Russia, but Russian military certainly is more efficient and has been kind of hardened and forged during this conflict. The reforms that they introduced in the aftermath of being beaten by Napoleon repeatedly are the reforms that allow the Russians then to continue on the quest for colonial expansion.
So speaking of Russia, one of the great generals in Russian history is Mikhail Kutuzov. He's probably he arguably rivaled the French emperor as well as his British ally Wellesley. What about Kutuzov specifically made you want to write about him, and what makes him so relevant today?
You've been a little bit too generous with Kutuzov there. No, there are some things that he's brilliant at, and some things that, of course, you know, you cannot but wonder what he was thinking. So one of the problems we face with kind of Napoleonic historiography, as in any historiography, there are dominant schools, right, historiographical schools. And usually it's French, British, Italian maybe, to a degree German. In my Napoleonic era, it's clearly French and British, because much of kind of what is written about is, as I mentioned, Western and Central European. And so there is a lack of really substantive, or there was, you know, lack of substantive work on Eastern European experiences. So some of it already been filled, as I said, by great scholars. And I've tried to do my own kind of share. So one of the gaps is, for example, in understanding, you know, kind of in the Napoleonic microhistory, so to speak, kind of looking at individual, the microhistorical look, and trying to understand how they fit the larger historical processes and what their lives, or their experiences, tell us about the greater historical processes. So, if you look at the Russian side, the last biography of the most successful and probably the most talented Russian general, of Alexander Suvorov, the last biography and the only English biography was published in 1966. This is ridiculous.
That's really
in French case, we have, in the last 10 years alone, we had more than a dozen biographies of Napoleon. We have almost complete reassessment of his generals, of his marshals, especially in French. We have biographies of every of his marshals that came out in the last few years. Now we are talking about biographies that are written about kind of division, in many respects, third rate, right, kind of generals, because all the top ones have been done. So I thought that that is inherently a disbalance, because what it creates is the disbalance of the perception of the war. If most of what is written is from the French point of view, then what you learn about the war is also French point of view, and you kind of lose the dimension, important dimension of it. I'll give you a good example. For a very long time, there was this myth. It's a myth that was started by a British historian, was then carried on by really good British historians who repeated this myth without critical analysis. And the myth was that in 1805, when Napoleon was confronted by the Third Coalition and went on to destroy them on the field of Austerlitz, right, on December 2nd, that one of the key reasons why these allies were defeated was because they had used different calendars. Russians were using Julian calendar, Austrians were using Gregorian calendar, and there was a 12-day difference, and that, oh my goodness, right, they were so stupid that they couldn't figure, you know, kind of make accounting for it, and Russians came too late. Now, when I came, kind of when I started learning, I mean, I always try to err on the side of complexity of human experience, right? I always shy away from this perception that people preceding us were dumber than us. If anything, they were more skilled or more experienced in a lot of things that we essentially nowadays take for granted. So I found that really hard to believe. And so in this book on Kutuzov, because Kutuzov was the commander-in-chief of the Russian army that went to fight Napoleon, I went blow by blow through the documents. And you realize that, of course, they were smarter than that. All of their documents were dated by both calendars. In fact, they made the deliberate effort in agreement to count everything by Gregorian calendar, since it was easier, right? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what we are talking about, is that when you there's a need to look at history from multiple points of view in order to enrich our understanding. And so the biography of Kutuzov is designed as such, especially because this guy had a remarkable career, right? He starts his service in 1762 and he dies in 1813. That's a long span of history when he's involved in almost every major war that Russians fight, right? So just looking at his experiences would have told us the story of Russian imperial aggrandizement, the story of Russian empire in 18th century. And if there is anything we have learned in the last few years, is that that story of Russian imperialism has not ended yet, right?
Something's never changed. So it is important
for us to understand. Yeah, exactly. So maybe, you know, my hope is that when we look at how Russians acquired Poland, because that's a core section, actually, of the Kutuzov's biography, his involvement in the Polish partitions, his governorship of Ukraine, his conflicts, his leadership of our Russian army in the Balkan Peninsula, right? It all of you kind of allows you to maybe gain a better grasp of how Russians, or at least in the 19th century, how Russians viewed themselves. And they, of course, viewed themselves as a great imperial power that was entitled to Poland, entitled to Ukraine, entitled to Finland, to my own homeland, Georgia.
And it's important that we understand the Russian psyche and mindset when it comes to conflicts like this, because without it, we run the risk of becoming prejudiced to the point of forgetting that they can actually, you know, they can do these things. They have been beaten before and they have been able to come back. I mean, I'm doing a series right now on Charles the 12th, who was 100 years previous to the Napoleonic Wars. And it was the same thing there. The Russians were all barbarians. They used sticks and clubs. And that's why they lost the Battle of Narva. It wasn't because they screwed themselves with their own defensive positioning. It was because of some, you know, racial thing, which seems completely stupid, if I could say. And the same thing with the calendar thing. It sounds completely ridiculous. I mean, they were right there. They could just look over and be like, hey, what day is it? They're like, oh, we think it's this day. Oh, we think it's this day. Okay, so it's like the same day.
Yeah, I know. Again, you know, when I talk to my students, I always emphasize the complexity, right? Complexity of human experience. It's simplifying history may be enticing and maybe kind of appealing to some of us because it's kind of it's easier way, but it's counterproductive because we must engage with complexity of history. I understand it. And that's especially true in the last few years, kind of the movement to reassess, right, the historical individuals, the discussion that we engage as a community, as a society, who we commemorate in monuments, in, you know, statues, in public sphere, right? These are very important conversations, but as we are engaged in this conversation, we must bear in mind that history is complex, right? And there are a lot of angles to it, and that we should try to actually engage that rather than evade and simplistically kind of assess the history.
Mm-hmm. Yes, agreed. So you mentioned him before, Alexander Suvorov. He was one of Kutuzov's mentors, and just like Suvorov, Kutuzov died right at the height of his powers, basically. I mean, he just arguably won the engagement on the Berezina. What lessons did Suvorov teach the young Kutuzov, and in what ways did the two diverge as commanders?
Well, I'm sorry but to say this, but Suvorov was not really a mentor. I think what I've discovered is that that relationship between Kutuzov and Suvorov as a mentor and disciple was a myth. I've actually looked kind of through the letters, documents, them kind of where they were, when they were, and I figured out that they probably spent together about 6 months, right? Maybe maximum a year if you kind of stretch it over the entirety of their career. And the longest stretch that they were together was when Suvorov was a teenager.
Wow.
And just finished out of school, just started his service, and he's been assigned to the regiment, and they spent several months together. I'm not sure how much 15 or 16-year-old can really learn in 6 months from an esteemed general like Suvorov, but especially in the peacetime.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure, again. I know that there was, Soviets certainly eulogized that relationship and turned Suvorov and Kutuzov into this great, tandem, great couple. They did serve later on in 1790, for example, 91, they are together in the Danubian principalities. And of course, Kutuzov is a right-wing commander, or actually the left-wing commander, to be precise, at the great storming, Russian storming of the Ottoman fortress of Ismail, which prompts Suvorov to famously says that Kutuzov was on the left, but he was my right hand.
Huh.
But frankly, I don't see that mentorship. In fact, I would go beyond that. If we look at the type of generalship, right, they practiced, Kutuzov is quite different. At no point was Suvorov ever described with the term Fabian. Right? At no point was he ever described as a great Roman commander, Fabian Conquistador, who defeated Hannibal by a slow, protracted, methodical war. And yet that was Kutuzov's nickname.
Wow.
They made fun of him as a modern-day Fabian. So mentally, I think they are quite different. The way they practice the war are also quite different. But they happen to be living at the same time, and they crisscross their paths, and they certainly rub the shoulders on occasion. But the extent of their relationship is overblown, and it's a Soviet historian's fault in creating that myth.
I was just going to ask where this came from, and it makes perfect sense that it was like a sort of Soviet lineage thing, one point to the next. Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Yeah. Now, even in the 19th century, we would think that the contemporaries would be comparing him as such, but they were not. They occasionally referred to him as a disciple, quote unquote, of Suvorov, but that's also kind of is a stretch. Kutuzov was a self-made man. Self-made man, but a man who started from a nice kind of starting position. He was a nobleman. He was sent, his parents valued education. They sent him to one of the best schools for military education. And throughout his life, Kutuzov was a bibliophile. He loved to read. He loved to engage in this kind of intellectual conversations. Emperor Paul, that's another myth, for example, that Kutuzov was kind of defender of all the Russianness, and he stood against Emperor Paul when he was introducing Prussian style reforms. No, if you look at the documents, the reality was that Paul and Kutuzov were actually very close, to the degree that Kutuzov was attending almost daily dinners with Emperor. And my favorite part was Paul has his own personal library, and he knew how much Kutuzov loved to read, so he would actually offer Kutuzov to come borrow books from his personal library so they can read together and discuss. So I like that kind of intellectual small club that they had.
It's interesting that he was turned into so much of a propagandized figure and given over to historical lineage of something that really wasn't there. Even to the point where I miscorrectly asserted that he was a mentor, which is interesting that it still sticks with us. And that's why it's so important to understand aspects of history from a different place like Russia, where maybe there's not as enough written about the Napoleonic wars.
Kutuzov is a poster child of myth making. Like Napoleon. Here he stands right there, a gift from my students.
There he is.
He's looking down and looking over my shoulder. But both of them are very good. I mean, they're examples of myth making, but of two different types. Napoleon is the myth maker in that he creates his own myth, right? He spends 6 years in exile, sits down, and essentially crafts the myth that becomes so contagious. And both of us, I think, come to Napoleonic history because we're lured by that, Promethean, titanic figure that, right, is Napoleon. But once you get up close, you realize it's actually a siren, right? It lures you, but once you get close, you see the ugly side of it. Mm-hmm. Kutuzov is a different type of myth. He didn't engage in myth making himself, but rather as soon as he dies, In 1813, as soon as he dies, the government steps in and starts turning him into a national hero, essentially into a national monument. And it starts with his own funeral, because he's the first and only, until 20th century, the first and only individual who was given essentially an imperial burial, a funeral. Wow. In fact, his funeral, when I looked at the cost, his funeral cost more than Emperor Paul's funeral. And one of the important elements in this, that he was not buried in some cemetery, but he was buried in a massive temple of military glory that was built for that purpose in St. Petersburg, right? So the great Kazan Cathedral, it was designed as the cathedral and a temple of Russian strength, imperial glory, imperial might. And here he is, the symbol of it all, the man who defeats Napoleon, buried in the middle of it. But it's done deliberately, kind of elevate him to the position of a national institution. And then that myth becomes even stronger and kind of more entrenched when Soviets kind of grab it, because Stalin, during World War II, wanted to conceal his own mistakes. Right? We know that he blew the first 2 years of the war. Right? And we know the price that the Soviets paid for it, millions and millions of lives, an enormous material destruction. And the way Stalin kind of tried to cover up is by employing history and by saying that, oh, we were not surprised by the Germans. We were not forced to retreat and abandon all that Western Soviet Union. This was part of our plan. And it was a plan that I, the great Stalin, learned from Kutuzov. And it was the same plan that Kutuzov implemented. We know both of that is bullshit.
Yeah.
But sometimes governments love selling bullshit in history.
Yeah,
that's so that Stalin essentially revolutionizes it and makes Kutuzov into that massive myth.
Very interesting. Very interesting.
Thank you so much for tuning in to part one. Tune in on December 17th for part two.
If you like what you heard today, you can support us by donating on PayPal at Turning Tides Podcast 1. Thanks for the support and thank you for listening.
If you like what you've heard, we'd really appreciate it if you take the time to rate and review Turning Tides on whatever platform you use to listen and share the show on social media. It really helps us to bring the show to more listeners. Thank you guys so much. Thank you to everyone for listening. We'd also like to say thank you to Movo Photo. We use their sound equipment for this podcast, as well as all of our other projects at Antics Entertainment. They make great equipment at great prices, and we really appreciate that they make content creating so accessible for indie creators like us. Check them out on social media at Movo Photo, MOVOPHOTO. Thank you again.